You know, World War II was won thanks to men and women all pulling their weight, doing the job they were assigned. When Bryans W.S. Edmonds enlisted in March of 1942, just 3 months after Pearl Harbor, he had field artillery in mind, even had a job stateside training ragtag replacements for overseas duty. Then, with little warning, his unit's job was changed to postal duty.
And I did not want to go overseas as a postal officer. I didn't like that idea at all. But my branch had been changed by Department Army of the Army. So I volunteered, was able to volunteer and go to Washington, D.C. and got involved in what they call the Army Courier Transfer Service, which handles all the classified material.
Yeah, Edmonds ended up with a job at the White House, where he worked nearby Roosevelt's War Map Room. He was finally transferred to the War in the Pacific, where it was his job to set up courier transfer stations. Now, soldiers learned many a lesson in the war. Among those, W.S. Edmonds learned the value of hard liquor.
Money wouldn't do you any good there. But if you had a quart of American whiskey, you could get a battleship.
You know, in World War II, just about every man and woman served in some capacity, and W.S. Edmonds said that for the most part, they did it without question.
There were some people that were drafted, but you didn't have the bitters. There were some of them, yeah, they did. But I think all of them, even though they were drafted, they were still there and not trying to get away. Most of them were there. Some of them I saw that had come in the service that had children and should never have been in there, but they wanted to be there and do their part, and they were there. If you walked down the street and you were somewhere near the age, you felt like people would treat you like a punk. Why aren't you in the service? For instance, the town of Leesville in Louisiana, a draft age person could not even come down the street unless he had a uniform on.
Edmonds says that once he was traveling with what he believes were maps for a ground invasion of Japan. That's an invasion that he says the world is fortunate never happened.
If it hadn't been for that bomb, I don't believe I'd be here. And I'd say this, it saved Japanese lives, it saved American lives. Because those Japanese were the folks of the last. But that atomic bomb, I think, saved lives, Japanese lives too, just as much as it did American lives.
After the Japanese surrender, W.S. Edmonds' unit was one of the first in Japan setting up the courier transfer stations. He's 85 years old now, has been in the Bryan College Station area for most of that time, Texas A&M, class of 1938. W.S. Edmonds, veteran from the Brazos Valley. I'm Tom Turbeville. For Meese and Kahn, attorneys at law, this is Bravo Brazos Valley. Let's return to the desolate Pacific Ocean as July turned to August in 1945 and Glenn Morgan and the remaining initial survivors of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. Of the 800 who did survive the torpedo explosion and the sinking, just 316 were eventually rescued. The rest were victims of exposure or sharks.
We were very fortunate. I was fortunate that I happened to pick a bunch of life rafts.
Yeah, those like Glenn Morgan in the life rafts were much better protected against the perils of the sea than those in life jackets. They also had rations, 3 ounces of water twice a day, and plenty of Spam.
With the Spam, we would make a sandwich, and there was 9 or 10 little pieces of slices of ham Spam that you could cut off of these things. And when we would throw the Spam can with its juice in it and everything into the water, is when this shark would come in close and snoop around pretty close, and so we got to calling this shark Charlie. Now I'm assuming it's the same one every day, but it looked like the same size. He was big. Don't know what kind he was, but he was kind of an olive green looking on top and white on bottom. And we never really paid much attention to Charlie. We just called him Charlie until one day I was watching this old shark, and we just got through throwing a Spam can in, and Charlie began to come in, and he headed right for the raft. I was sitting on the edge at this time, and I said, well, look at old Charlie. And I just slid in as he got closer, and he came up to the edge of the raft, which, of course, the edges are just not very far above the water line. And his head came up and slid right up on the raft. He never tried to bite. Now, I didn't offer him my finger or anything, but he slid back in. I have no idea why. He just did it.
Now, the group of 20 on Glenn Morgan's 4 rafts in the Pacific was one of several groups of survivors, but no group could see or hear another. So each group of sailors figured that they were the only survivors of the Indianapolis. Day 2 turned tonight, as did day 3. But at dusk on day 4 came the first suggestion of hope. In the far distance, Glenn Morgan had thought he had seen a bird. He had indeed seen an airplane.
After seeing this plane, we were enthusiastic and came to life, you might say. Then as it got dark, blue searchlights stabbed the sky. Then we knew that they were trying to let us know that help was on its way.
The incredible story of survival by Glenn Morgan and the other 315 survivors of the USS Indianapolis cannot be told in radio sound bites. There's the whole episode of the court-martial of Captain Charles McVeigh. That's a whole other story. If you want to know more, I recommend 2 books, Abandoned Ship by Richard Newcomb and All the Drowned Sailors by Raymond Leck. Or go to the website ussindianapolis.org. Or you could be lucky like me and have the honor of knowing Glenn D. Morgan, bugler, USS Indianapolis.
You know, we did a lot of praying, but I can tell you this, that I had read stories about people surviving for 3 months. I didn't see why we couldn't.
I'm Tom Turbeville. From Eason Kahn, Attorneys at Law, this is Bravo Brazos Valley.